Okay, let's get started, please. Firstly, if you... God, our sound seems to get rather... I don't know if I can control the volume here. This is rather louder than usual, right? and I'm not seeing any volume control. Is that any better? Is that... No. Maybe if I talk quietly, is that any better? I'm sorry? I probably need to have this on so the video records properly. If I don't do this, then you come back to look at the video, or anybody else does who's missing today, won't be able to hear the audio properly. So I need to do it, but I'll have a word with the servitors or whoever does this AV equipment. I mean, this is... It sounds here a bit loud, and I assume for you too this is a bit loud. Yes, it's okay. You can do it. Okay. All right. Firstly, admin issues. So I promised you last week that I'd get labs set up. So labs will be starting this week tomorrow. You should check on the web page for the exact time of labs, but the idea basically is labs will run, there'll be three labs a week. I get this right. Monday, so this is, check on the website. Can somebody pull up the website and on the front page, just double check that these times are the right times. I think I've got them the right way around. Yep, they're good. Okay, so they're going to be three labs a week, Monday 2 to 3, Wednesday 3 to 4, Thursday 11 to 12. I hope nearly all of you can make at least one of these times. Is there anybody here for whom all those times are bad? Wonderful, good. So please make use of these labs. So what we're doing is we're running these labs continuously now until beginning of week 10. And you know, as I said last week, in the run-up to practical deadlines, we'll be running extra labs as well. So I think on the 8 days running up to a deadline, 8 weekdays, there will be additional labs between 5 and 6 in the afternoon. And I will put on more staff in the last days towards the deadline, but please, please, please start the homeworks early and go to the labs early as well. You'll get much more individual, detailed attention if you go to the labs well before a deadline than if you race in 10 minutes before the end of the last lab before the hand-in. There'll be lots of other people demanding time from the demonstrators then, and they won't. And they won't afford you much time. This is gone completely, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Does seem pretty dead. Great, yes, it's flashing. Of course, they don't give us any spare batteries, do they?
Well, maybe they do.
There's a box, which is empty. Is this picking up?
Yeah.
Okay. So I guess if I stand here, probably something will get recorded for the slides, for the video. Great. All right. Anyway, so that's about the labs. Good luck with them. And good luck with the practical, which should hopefully be out this Thursday. Also, I'll email around about that. Well, right, yeah, back to what we're talking about. So last week on Friday, we started an introduction to the C language. And so as you remember, this was kind of building on, hopefully, what you've seen already of Java. So looking at the main differences with Java. And last week, one of the things I was doing was walking through some of the different data types that you've got there in the C language. And we were talking about structures, like these things called structs. And I just got up to talking about what are called union structures, which are not something that you see there in Java. Let's get rid of this thing. Go away. There we go. So a union declaration looks superficially something like a structured declaration. You have a keyword, and you have the name of the type you're defining. And then it's got fields, and in this case, we're saying we're declaring a single variable to have this what's called union type. But what's different, what makes a union structure different from a normal struct structure, is the different fields, the two or more fields, all overlap in memory. This is kind of rather bizarre. You might wonder why you want to do this. We'll kind of come on to that in a second. But here's a simple example, a simple picture that hopefully kind of gives you the idea. So here we've got a structure with two integer fields, and those fields get laid out adjacent to each other in memory. On the other hand, if you declared a union structure with two integer variables, then the same location in memory is given two names, both var1 and var2. So if you'd had ux.var1, and ux.var2, those would still both refer to the same data. Now, in this case, it might seem a bit pointless. The use of a union is really when you want to be very economical with memory and say you want to return one of several different kinds of data, say from a method or function you've just written. Maybe sometimes you want to return an integer, sometimes you want to return a float, sometimes maybe you want to return a structure of some kind. And one way of doing this, so one thing you could do is declare a structure with fields all of those different types, and then you just use the field that you want and disregard the rest. An alternative that you have in the C language is to use this union data structure and have the actual storage of all those different types of data that you could return overlap, because you know at any one time you only ever want to use that storage, that memory, for one purpose. So the use of the union type is a little bit delicate. You've got to be quite careful in your programming, because obviously if you are you've got to synchronize whoever's in storing data into a union type and whoever's taking the data out. Generally, what you want to avoid is somebody putting in data of one type and then somebody else trying to read that data as if it were something else. So if somebody stores in an integer and then you read the data there as if it were a float. If you're doing that kind of operation, then things can go badly wrong. So there has to be some other way in which kind of programs know how a union data object's being used. All right, so in C you can define types. So the syntax is given at the top there, type def. You give some type expression and then you give a name. So for example, in Java you've got this type of bytes. In the C language, there is no such type of bytes. But you might say, well, I want byte to be an unsigned 8-bit type. In that case, you might make a type def like the following. So unsigned car is the way of asking for an 8-bit type, which is not a 2's complement number, but just an unsigned number between 0 and 255. Here we're giving this type name byte. Here's another example here. So with structures, this may seem a bit odd. We're defining a structure here, a struct with these two fields. But after the keyword struct, there's no name. Instead, we're putting a name here. So this is an alternative way of giving a name to a particular struct type. This particular idiom in C is the preferred idiom over what I showed you a couple of slides ago, this one here. So here we're saying struct point. We're putting the name of the type after the keyword struct. And the point is, if we do it this way, when we want to refer to the type, we have to say struct point again. We have to use two words, a keyword struct again, and then the name of the structure type. On the other hand, when we're over here, and we define circle to be the kind of type name for the structure here, we can just write the word circle by itself. We don't have to say struct circle. So a little bit of a fine point and kind of indication of how the C language evolved, that this type def facility wasn't there in the start, but people thought it would be very useful, so they added it in. So now you've got two ways of giving structures names. But this is usually the preferred one. All right, move on to arrays. So the syntax of arrays is similar to that in Java. So let's look at an example here. So you can declare n to be an array of integers. And here we're going to initialize it to be a three-element array containing the integers 5, 8, and 10. Here we can also have an array of structures, for example. Here we're declaring C to be an array holding four structures from this circle structure type that we defined on the previous slide. A big difference between arrays in C and arrays in Java is that in Java you've got, I think it's the dot length or the dot size method on arrays. I forget which one it is. Is it dot length? Yeah. So if you do array name dot length, you find out how long that array is, and you can easily figure out what is a valid index into that array. And indeed, if you try accessing an element in an array at its length or beyond, or use an array index which is less than zero, you'll get an exception thrown in Java. In C, things are much more liberal. A C array doesn't know anything about its length, and if you try indexing beyond the end of an array or before the beginning, nothing will happen at all at that stage. But what you will be doing is, say, either reading data from, or even worse, writing data to some memory location that could be used for some very different purpose. In the worst case, what you might be doing is actually, say, if this array was stored in one of these stack frames, you might corrupt the return address of a function that you're currently executing, and then you try to return, and you go just to some random place. Now, of course, if you're a hacker, this actually might be desirable, because then you can return to some location in your code. But generally, this is really bad behavior, just something you've got to be aware of that can happen in C programming. So in C, it turns out to be a very strong, close relationship between pointers and arrays. And we'll see that in the next two, three slides. Actually, we'll see it after the slide. So here what we're going to do is just look at one common instance of arrays using arrays of arrays to store strings. So strings in C are nothing more than arrays of 8-bit cars. So they are each character, as I said before, in C we just use 8-bit ASCII characters. We don't use 16-bit Unicode like you got in Java. In C, one nice thing about strings is they decided on a convention that that strings will always be terminated by what's called the null character, which happens to be
the character with all zeros in its pattern. And when we want to enter it, typically we use this backslash zero syntax as the syntax for it. So because you could allow for this null character, when you declare an array for holding a string, it always holds one fewer characters than you expect. So here we've got we're declaring a char array of length 10. And actually, since always we want to allow for the last element of the array being a null character, we actually only have 9 usable positions in that array. Here's an example of how we initialize an array. So here, for example, we say this is going to be an array holding 10 characters, and we're going to set its initial value to be string, to be this sequence of 6 characters, and then a 7th character being a null character. There will be, in the statement, we've reserved 10 locations in memory for the string. So in future, it will be possible for us to overwrite each of those 9 or 10 character positions with some new character if we should wish to. This is another way of setting a variable, initializing a variable to have as value a character string. In this case, we haven't specified a length of the character, the length of the string. And actually what happens is the system doesn't reserve any space in memory to hold the array variable. The consequence of this, so what it does is there's a constant part of memory which holds this string here, and this variable here refers to that string, this sequence of characters held in a fixed part of memory. But if you use this kind of declaration, then you're not free to then go and modify any of those fields, because there's not been any storage, any separate storage reserved for the array S1, which then you could subsequently modify. Unlike the situation here, where really what happens when you compile this is this string here, the sequence of 6 characters, is held in some constant part of memory, but when this statement's executed, it actually copies this string into the sequence of 10 locations that's been reserved here. So, in summary, when you are, you can't store, as it says there, more characters into an array than are reserved at the time you declare the array. However, you are actually free to try to do so, and you won't get any immediate error flagged. You'll just be writing data into places in memory where you shouldn't be writing data. So you've got to watch it. Oh, a bit more on strings here. So if you the C language comes with a library of utility functions for manipulating these strings, these arrays of characters. And there are a couple of examples here. So there's one called strcpy, which simply copies one string into a different location. So this copies, in this case, say, a constant string here into the char star variable, or variable with type char star, s here. Another one here asks for the length of the string. So this just works down the string looking for a null character. We can lexicographically compare two strings with this strcmp here. It returns a 0 when they're equal, a negative number when S1 is before S2 in alphabetical order, and a positive number if S1 is after S2 in alphabetical order. To get access to these, if you want to use these in your program, what you would do is include this string.h header, and this declares these three functions and many more as well. and then you're free to use those in your program. If you want to see the collection of string utilities in C, then type man string at a command line, any terminal window under DICE or under Linux, and you'll see a online manual page which describes, at least very briefly, it will give you the names of all the functions, and then you can type man for individual function name. Like if you typed man strcpy, you would get a dedicated man page just for that particular function, which would describe it in detail. All right, so that's one example of strings. Let's or one example of arrays. Let's go on to talk a bit more about pointers. So we saw pointers when we were talking about MIPS a week ago. So for example, so a pointer, remember, is really just an address of data. So here we can think of the variable held in register S2. Well, in this case, it gives an address from which we fetch data, and then which is then stored into register $st1. So $s2 points to the location in memory where the real data is kept. This is the kind of picture that we can have. We've got the memory here, we've got this register here. The contents of the register is an address. This address in hex 100, and it's that address there which holds the data. In this case, we have a register holding address, but there's no problem with actually having another memory location holding an address as well. So we might have some memory location down here that also is holding the address 0x hex 100. And in C, we're allowed to, these pointers are a pointer to data of some type, is itself a type of data. So you can have pointers to integers, pointers to you name it, and any type you wish. So a C pointer is a variable which holds the address of a piece of data. Here we see how you declare a variable to have pointer type. So here, this is the way in which we say P is a pointer to an integer. The type, we read the type here as int star, even though the star is kind of stuck, in this case, next to the P. What's happening here in the C language is they are using the star operator for two purposes. We'll come to it very shortly, that the star operator is what we say, it's called a dereferencing operator. You give it a pointer, and then it gives you back the data that the pointer points to. We'll see an example of this very shortly. So down here, so say I has just been declared to be of type integer, or some location in memory of type integer. If we declared P like this up here, and then we said P equals ampersand I, what the ampersand operator does is it takes the address of something, in this case the address of a variable. So here we're saying initialize this pointer here to have as value the address at which the variable I is stored. And then the expression star P doesn't refer to the pointer itself, but refers to the data location that's pointed to by P. So this is the way of saying modify the location pointed to by P to have the value 5. So this P here, star P, you can imagine is another name for the location at which the variable I is stored. So the star, the normal use of the star is as a dereferencing operator. It tells us where the pointer is pointing. It gives us the data that's pointed to. And that's why it's used up here in the type, that here, the way which we can think about this is we've got P, and we dereference it, and we get back an integer. So the type declaration is kind of giving us is modeled on a pattern of usage for the pointer. And this is a kind of a common idiom in C as well. If you kind of look at the syntax for declaring arrays, it also uses the same syntax as is used for accessing an array element. And there's no coincidence there that they try to mimic in the declaration of the type of an array the way in which you actually use an array. All right, so this is the basic concept of a variable of pointer type. So here we kind of come back to kind of key use of pointers, and in which is to pass arguments to functions in a certain way. So firstly, I need to recap what happens in Java and the difference between what's called passing by value and passing by reference. So back in Java, when you have an int or a bool or a float and you pass it to as an argument to a function, what you're doing is you're passing a copy of that data, and then the method that you're passing the data to works on that local copy but doesn't affect where you got that data from. Doesn't affect the original data. So if you had So say we've got a Java function, a Java method f, which takes as argument some argument I, and then in our program we've got int j, we do something which involves a call of f with j, and then say we want to look at the value of j. So there's no way f here can actually change the value of this j here, because it gets a copy of that value. So in Java we say arguments are passed by value. The value is copied into the method when you make the call. By contrast, when you pass an object into a method, what you're passing is a reference to that object. You're not passing the object itself. And this means that if I were of some class type, say capital I, and now we declare j to be of that type there, and we made this function call here, and say f in its body actually made some change to this argument here, then you'd see that change in the value of j down here. Is everybody with me there? Does that correspond to what you've been taught about Java and what you understand about Java from last year? It's a really, really important point to understand if you haven't fully grasped that, because if you get this wrong when you're programming, you'll be making all kinds of horrendous mistakes. So there's this huge difference between passing values and passing references. And in Java, they made the decisions for you. When you're passing primitive types, you're always passing by value. When you're passing objects, you're always passing references. In C, we give you much more flexibility. So superficially, in C, whenever you pass an argument to a function, you are always passing a value. However, any time you want to pass a reference, or if you were kind of thinking with a Java hat on and you want to pass a reference, what you do in C instead is you pass a pointer to whatever data you care about. And then when you pass a pointer into a function, that pointer is pointing back to the original data, and when the function makes some modifications to that data, it's making modifications to the original copy of the data, not to some other version of it. So those changes are permanent in some way. So that's kind of how C is kind of more flexible, gives you more options than you have in Java. Let's see an example of this happening. So here we have a swap function, and the objective of the swap function is to for you to be able to give it two locations in memory holding integers and ask for the values in those two locations, in those two variables, to be swapped, to be interchanged. So a naive attempt at writing that might be like at the top here, that you load in two variables, two arguments, A and B. Okay, you pull them in, you assign a temporary variable to have the value stored in A, you then make A equal to B and B equal to the temp. Maybe if you never knew anything about programming before and you saw this, you think it may be possibly plausible. But as soon as you know anything about copying, you know immediately that both in Java and indeed in C as well, that this program's just not going to make any sense. It's not going to do anything for you. I mean, sure, yes, if you wrote this in Java and it was dealing with objects, not integers, yes, it would make sense because it would be dealing with references. But if you're passing copies of arguments into a method or a function, this top function is going to do nothing for you. It's not touching the original data at all. It's only touching the copies, which are then thrown away as soon as the function exits. In C, this is the way in which you would code this properly. What you'd say is, what you'd do instead is you'd pass in a pointer to an integer A and a pointer B also to an integer. And then you do the swap as before. And because this swap function now has access to the pointers, it has access through those pointers to the original data. And so it is able to swap around the data held in those two locations, which are pointed to. And if, say, you had X and Y both declared to be of type integer, then you could say, look, let's call swap with the address of X and the address of Y, and you would get the effect that you desire. So if you've understood how addresses and how pointers work okay, you should see how this function here will work correctly. Does anybody want to ask any questions about this? Was this reasonably clear?
And the integer t equals star a. As I understood, star a is just a pointer, right?
Okay, so a is a pointer to an integer. So it's a variable which holds the address at which an integer is stored. So the way in which we would kind of picture it is say, here's a location in memory for the variable A. It holds a pointer to some other cell in memory, which actually holds an integer. So some integer, let's say 3, in that cell. And so when we say T equals star A, what we're doing is we've got now a location for t, and we're saying t gets the value held in the cell pointed to by a. So in this case, a points to a cell location holding the variable 3, so t equals star a makes t equal to 3, makes the value held in the location for variable t equal to 3. Does that answer your, kind of clarify things? Any other questions? So if you want, a good nice exercise to do is just to kind of work through, is to draw some pictures with cells and boxes and arrows and so on, and just walk through line by line what's actually happening when this call here is executing. If you want, so I think in a week or two, not next week, but later on you'll have the tutorial on C. That should be a kind of good example to walk through if you're at all unsure about what's going on. Or else catch a demonstrator at some time and ask him or her. All right, let's move on. Now we're kind of getting to the connection between arrays and pointers and how often they're, in some sense, interchangeable. So what have we got at the top here? We've got a variable a, which is an array of 10 integers. And we've got p, which is a pointer to an integer. We're allowed to write the following. So what's going on here? The bracketing is around A0. So we're taking the address of A0. So A0 is the first element in the array A. And by taking the address of it, we're just saying, here's the address of the first element. So the pointer now, the P, points to the first address of the array A. So the kind of picture you might have in mind is, here's our array A. Here's the location. There is A0. And now we've got P. We've got P points there. All right, so then we can write an expression, p plus 1. Now, what's happening here is a little bit smart. So naively, you might think, well, pointers are addresses. So p plus 1 must be an address plus 1. But C is a little bit smarter than that and does what you want rather than just doing naive arithmetic here. So C knows what a pointer is a pointer to. It knows it's a pointer to an integer, or it knows that you've got a pointer to a structure or something. And it knows often that when you've got a sequence of things that are being pointed to, then if you want to do p plus 1, what you want to do is point to the next thing in that sequence, in that array. And so p plus 1 will actually point to the next element, which if you say these are a 4-byte integers, then actually the address one location up will be the address of the previous item plus 4. Or if these were 8-bit integers, it would be 8-byte integers, it will be the address here plus 8, even though we actually write plus 1 there. So it says up there, the compiler multiplies the number you put there, you could put plus 2 or plus 3 as well, and multiplies this by the size of the data type. In general, P plus I points to AI. And if we dereference P plus I, then that's the same as talking about the item which is stored at location I in array A. So using pointers, we can use pointers very often to look at and modify the contents of arrays. We're even allowed to write expressions like this as well. So here now, we're treating an array like an index. We're using kind of pointer syntax with the name of an array, and we're just adding a constant to the array name. And then we're dereferencing it, and so this is allowed. And we can have a pointer p, and we can use array syntax with a pointer. And this, again, this here is shorthand for this here. Is translated into this here. So to a large extent, pointers and array variables are interchangeable. The one difference you've got to be careful of is the following here. It says you can't change what A points to. It's not a variable. So whereas up here, this pointer P is a variable. It's some cell in memory whose contents we can change. A here is it's kind of fixed location. We can't change what we can change is the locations in the array A. So A0, A1, A2, those are the things that we can change. Those are kind of that's the storage associated with A. But we can't use the variable, we can't say A equals A plus 1 or A equals something else by itself. We're not allowed to do that because A itself is not an address. I mean, it's not an address that you're allowed to change in your program. So there's a kind of subtle difference between the two concepts. So they're not quite the same, but they're very similar for many purposes. All right, let's move on. More point arithmetic. So you can write these wonderful expressions. So here, star p plus plus. So we've got these plus plus and minus minus operators like you have in Java. The plus plus binds more tightly. So p plus plus and then star means do the plus plus. Well, so if you remember, plus plus afterwards is called a post increment operator. It says return the value of the of whatever you're applying the plus plus to, and then increment it. So here's a way of incrementing the pointer p, but first returning the data pointed to by p. So use value pointed to by p, but make p point to the next element. You could also write something like this. This is pre-incrementing now. Increment p first, and then get the data held by it using the dereferencing operator. If you write this, this looks a bit like this, but it's doing something quite different. So here, the plus plus is applied to the data that p points to. So here, we're not changing the pointer value at all. What we're changing is the value stored in the cell that p points to. There's a special value, null, used for showing that a pointer is not pointing to anything. So very often we talk about, it's very useful to have some default value we can set pointers to that shows that they're not in use at a given time. Typically, null is zero. It's the address zero. So you can have statements like if bang p. So this means if p is not zero, do something. However, this is very bad practice for portable code. There are operating systems and architectures where null is not zero. So you've really got to watch this. It's always best to use, if you're programming C, use this symbolic null. A very, very common error that you'll get in C programs is called a null pointer exception. It's a situation where you try to dereference a null pointer. So you're trying to follow where a null pointer is pointed to, but it doesn't point anywhere. So typically you get some kind of memory violation, and the operating system halts your program at that point, or effectively you see your program crash. Here's an example to show some of this use of pointers and point arithmetic. One way in which we might define this strlen function. So it's going to take an array of characters here, and as I was saying earlier, strings are always terminated by null characters. So what this function is going to do is just count down a string looking for this null character. We're going to have a local variable called p, which is a pointer to a character. And we're going to make this a pointer to, we're going to copy the input pointer. So initially p is equal to the input pointer. Then we've got a very short loop here, which has no body at all. So everything, all the actions going on in the test itself. And what we're doing here is we're saying, hey, let's look at what S points to, and let's see if it's not equal to the null character. And if it's not equal to the null character, let's go round the loop again. But of course, also, let's increment S, so it points to the next character each time we examine its value. So what this while loop does is it just walks down the string until it reaches a position in the string that holds a null character. And then down here, what we're going to do is we're going to do some arithmetic. We're going to take, we're going to subtract one pointer value from another pointer value. And again, the compiler is going to do something smart. It's going to do this with an awareness of the size of the data stored in the pointer, in the pointers. So, well, in this case, we're dealing with characters where a character just takes up one byte. But in general, if you did this subtraction here, it would do the appropriate conversion between, it would, do the appropriate conversion. So it would tell you, we can assume that S and P were both pointing to positions in an array, and it would tell you how many array elements were between these two pointers. All right, so one example there. I'm running out of time here. Let me just check how much I've got to do. I'm going to do this one slide here, then we'll break. And there'll be just a couple more slides. We'll finish them at the beginning of the next lecture. So it says at the top there, pointers are not much use with statically allocated data. Best way to phrase that, I think maybe it wouldn't be quite so strong. I'd say that typically, if you look at how pointers are used in programs, 99% of the time, they're used in conjunction with data that's stored in the heap. Occasionally, they can be used to point to data that's stored in the stack or stored in static areas as well. I mean, there's nothing wrong with doing that, but it's typically in the way in which they're used. If you're kind of typically writing programs using pointers, most commonly, you're using them to refer to items on the heap, for the reason that pointers are really the only way of referring to things on the heap. Whenever you name a variable in C, it's always that data is always stored either on the stack or in a static area. If you've got any data on the heap, the only way of talking about it is using pointers. Here we see examples of the system provided functions in C for allocating a new piece of data on the heap, and then explicitly saying to the runtime system for C, hey, this particular location or set of locations is no longer used by me. You can recycle this and have somebody else use it. So here, there's a function called malloc, allocates multiple locations. And what you do to malloc is you give it an argument, which is the number of bytes of memory that you want on the heap. What we've got here is a function called sizeof. This is a very special thing that looks like a function in C, which you give as argument a type, and it gives you back the number of bytes that type occupies in memory. So here, sizeof int typically will return 4, but it might return 8 or 2, depending on what system you're using. And so here what we're saying is, give me, say, the sum value stored in the variable n. We're saying give me space on the heap for storing n integers. And what we get back is a pointer to an integer. So essentially what's being allocated is a sequence of consecutive locations, which we could treat as an array if we want to. Here we're being a bit smart. We're checking that the pointer we get back is not null. And if it is null, then we'll execute some error code here. The idea here is that in the extreme case, you've been so profligate in your program, you've used up all available memory on the heap, and you've said to the system, well, give me even some more memory. And the system says, no, I've run out of memory. And the way it tells you that is it gives you back a null pointer rather than a pointer to real data. Then when you've used, say, this array that's been pointed to by the variable p, and you want to be a good citizen, good programmer, and recycle it, then you call free P. And the C runtime system is smart enough to know that P, to know the size of the array that P points to when you say free P. So instead of in Java, you've got this automatic garbage collector, and so you never have to write these free statements. In C, it's your obligation as a programmer to manage this heap. If you don't manage it,